Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. I apologize for the delay this morning. We had some trouble connecting to Zoom, as I'm sure you know. So I appreciate your patience. The next case on our calendar today is A21-0964, Elm Creek Court Home Association, Inc. versus State Farm Fire and Casualty Company. The oral argument is proceeding by Zoom. The same procedural rules apply to this Zoom oral argument as apply to our in-person oral argument. Each party will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll note that we are recording the oral argument and no additional recording is permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. Hopefully you can all see the timer in the grid view on Zoom. The marshal will be keeping the time. If there are any technology issues along the way, the marshal will stop the clock and we'll make sure you get your full allotment of time for the oral argument today. So with that, we can proceed. Counsel, I'll just ask that you please identify yourself and the party you represent when you begin your argument. And counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Alex Jaden from Smith Jaden Johnson. And today I represent the appellant Elm Creek Court Homes Association. The dispute today is between an insured and an insurance company, but the decisions by the court on these issues will have an impact on policyholders and insurers statewide. Before the court today, there are two primary issues. The first is whether this insurance policy allows for a repair to property using discarded materials. And second, the question of not whether it is provided, but rather how pre-award interest on an appraisal award is calculated. For the first topic, Your Honors, what we're kind of colloquially calling the harvesting issue, is the starting point for this analysis is within the requirements of the insurance policy's loss payment provisions. Now, neither State Farm nor honestly our office can identify any portion of this policy that provides for a repair method to property that consists of using discarded materials. Now, for sort of some clarity on insurance stuff, and I know the court's heard plenty of insurance claims over the years, but there are sort of two types of policies. You've got a replacement cost policy, which is subject today, versus something called an actual cash value policy. Now, common interest communities, which my client is, have requirements to maintain a replacement cost policy. And within that, there's extra cost that goes with it. It is a better coverage. It offers more value and more coverage when there is a claim. So, given context and with how this dispute got here through the appraisal process, I think it's important to point out from our view that what the policy allows and what the policy doesn't allow is a question of coverage.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to 1 minute. You keep focusing on discarded. Would you respond to the State Farm's argument found on page 14 of their primary brief, indicating that your own public adjuster did never use the word harvesting means using discarded? I guess the first question is, did he describe harvesting as using discarded or not?
I don't believe that there's anything in the record that says that the public adjuster used that phrase. I would say that the word discarded comes from my own analysis of what it means to take used materials from one building, take them off of the building, and instead of throwing them in the trash, putting them onto a different building as a replacement cost. So the word discarded comes from my analysis of what is actually happening in procedure here, Your Honor.
So what if we disagree with your analysis? Do you lose on the harvesting issue?
I don't think that that's the only option in which that issue arises. I think there is also, as we'll go into later, a question of sort of the ambiguity in the policy and what is allowed. I don't know that the word discarded is the trigger word here. I think the question is, what is allowed under the policy? And to that specific point, two of the two main points of what is required under the policy is number one, undepreciated materials, which, whether you want to call it used, discarded, worn, or on that building for 10 years, that is a depreciated material. And second, Your Honor, the point within the loss payment provision that requires the use of other property. This is undisputably not other property. It is the same siding at the same association. So whether you agree with my analysis on the word discarded, Your Honor, I think there are other avenues in which you can reach our conclusion.
Would that include the reasonable expectations argument that you're making?
Yes, Your Honor, that is also, and I can jump into that, but that's one I'd like to spend some time on because I think that's very important based on the context of this party.
Would you agree with me that at least Atwater seems to talk about reasonable expectations as a hidden major exclusion, an ambiguity, or other special circumstance? Would you agree that that's what Atwater says expectation talks about?
Within your context, yes, Your Honor, I agree with your characterization.
Which one is yours?
Which
of those three contexts are you arguing applies in this case? Are you arguing there was a hidden major exclusion?
Yes, that is the primary one. And secondary, Your Honor,
would you point to me in the policy part of the record, what language is the hidden major exclusion?
Well, being that it's hidden, I would say that it's actually a reverse argument here, Your Honor. And that's the policy says a specific thing. It's a replacement cost policy using other material. The hidden exclusion in here is using silence on this methodology and trying to enforce it as a repair mechanism. So the hidden information here is my client acquiring a replacement cost policy with the expectation that when they have a claim arise, that they will have uniformity and they will have a full replacement, but the policy being used to provide them with something lesser, depreciated materials used.
It's been a challenging morning, but we're all back on the Zoom here. And the marshal has adjusted the clock to 9 minutes and 30 seconds. Counsel, you can maybe start from the beginning of your answer. That would probably be most appropriate at this point. Thank you.
If I could ask the court's indulgence, Judge Connolly, would you mind kind of drilling into your question? I guarantee you I gave a brilliant answer, but I cut out and I was talking to nothing.
Yes, Mr. Counsel, what I was asking you was, I asked you under Atwater, I think we had agreed that you were just saying that the exception here for the reasonable expectations is that this is a hidden major exclusion, and you were elaborating on why it's that one for this case.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe you asked if there was specific language, and I believe my answer was, you know, and Your Honor, I don't have a specific language, and I think that's sort of the point of the hidden portion of this. It's that I read the explicit language to pretty clearly articulate what is required for an insurance company to pay to a policyholder, and the two specific ones here are other property and not depreciated materials. The hidden argument here is that that's not what the carrier is arguing it provides. And it's an important context for the type of client I have in this case, Your Honor. And that is, it's a community association. It's a common interest community is the legal term for it. It is 21 buildings, 80 plus unit owners that live in it. And there are expectations when the board of these associations acquire insurance policies for the common and limited common elements of what those requirements are. And the hidden nature here is my client in their policy believes they're getting full replacement, uniform materials, you know, full new materials to fix the problem. And the policy, the argument from the carriers that no, they're not. That is a hidden exclusion within this policy in which my clients are not being provided with what they intended or what they thought when they acquired this policy, Your Honor.
Counsel, is there any case law that establishes that repair or replacement means repairing or replacing with new materials?
I can't.
Under a standard policy like this?
I can't give you a case off the top of my head. I would say that the closest argument I have is I believe it's in 65A10, which is the replacement cost statute, the requirement of replacement cost statute. The other one, and I don't have it sitting in front of me here, but if you give me a second, the other one that's relevant just from a statutory point of view is the what's commonly called in Kiowa, that's the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act. And within there, I don't have the exact site, and maybe I can grab that later for your honor. It requires that an association maintain full replacement cost coverage for their common elements and their limited common elements at the association. It is a fiduciary duty of the board at these nonprofit associations to maintain that insurance. So when they believe they're in the market and they're acquiring a full replacement cost policy, and then in practice they're not, that absolutely affected the reasonable expectations of that insured. They have a requirement to obtain that, and they're not getting it. So absolutely, I believe that to Judge Connolly's question, that is a hidden exclusion, or maybe a better way to say it is it's a hidden limitation within the policy. I don't know that it's necessarily fair to call it a exclusion, but it's a limitation on what my client is being afforded within their policy.
Let's assume for a moment that there are 20 buildings and one building is damaged, or two buildings are damaged, and they take material from one and put it on the other. Is there a point at which using those materials is appropriate, in your opinion?
No,
it's never appropriate.
It's never appropriate under a replacement cost policy to use those used, worn, and discarded materials from one building to another. I don't think there's a scenario in which that's ever appropriate. I think that we would, you know, if I wanted to give you a scenario that makes sense here, if you've got a single building and they sided it 5 years ago, and they've got a couple boxes of leftover siding that were never installed, that's not a used material. That's the same one. Put that up there to make the replacement. That doesn't have any wear and tear. That's not a depreciated material. It's never been installed. I think really the crux of my argument here, Your Honor, is once materials are installed on a building, whether they're siding, whether they're roofing materials, whether they're a window, they're no longer undepreciated. And in addition, they're not other property. So in a replacement cost policy in which we pay a premium for it and we have expectations that go with it, adding in these hidden limitations is not appropriate. It is not what's expected. And if that's what we knew when we went into the acquisition of this policy, wouldn't you bought that policy? Knowing that this would be the outcome when we got it, you wouldn't buy that policy, no homeowner would. I think, Your Honor, I'm going to only have a few more minutes here.
Mr. Jane, I was wondering if we could switch to the pre-interest issue. And my specific question on that is, you know, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I am at a loss to understand under the statute or Blair how, you know, the loss report from them to you is a written notice of claim from you to them.
Well, Your Honor, the statute does not require or identify which party makes the written notice. And I think if you go to the Creekview of Hugo case, I think that one is the one that specifies that out. That's a federal district court case. The statute says pre-award starts from the time of a written notice of claim. It does not prescribe who has to provide it. And in this case, we're arguing that no later than the September 20th, 2017, written documentation from State Farm substantiates which was actually a notice of the claim that was turned in earlier. There's nothing in the record that I can point to that it was in writing. I presume it probably was, but for the court's argument, we're conceding that I can't show you a written document before that, but the plain language of the statute simply says a written notice of claim does not identify who is required to do it. And I think, Your Honor, that goes into what is my broader position on interest. And that is, I don't see this being a complicated issue. I think this is a plain language of the statute. I think the interest clearly starts from a first written notice. It clearly in the statute runs on the full award from the date of that written notice to the appraisal date. I don't see any language in the statute that provides for any offsets in the guise of pre-award interest, though I do when we're talking about post-award interest, which is very telling. And I'll just give an analogy to our argument on harvesting. I'm of the position that the words that the drafters of these documents matter. you can show that the legislature intended offsets to apply to post-award interest. They literally used those words. They'd say that it's interest on the unpaid balance. There's no such language in the pre-award section. The words matter. State Farm wrote a policy for replacement costs. There's nothing in that policy that identifies that you can use used or discarded materials. There's nothing in there that says harvesting is an appropriate methodology. The drafters of the statute and the drafters of the contracts, the words they choose to use and the words they choose not to use matter and have consequence in the analysis of these issues. So again, just on the interest, going back to that, the plain language of the statute to me is clear. The application of the Supreme Court's decision in Paylor allowing for pre-award interest answers that question. To the extent of any of these analysis on what is the proper methodology and mechanism of calculation, I think the plain language of the statute is the only place the court needs to go, and it answers all their questions.
Jane, could you just cite to that case you referenced before dealing with written notice of claim? You said it was a Creeky, a federal case?
It was Creekview of Hugo. And let me just pull
up. Do you just cite that? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Creekview of Hugo. I apologize. Thank you.
First auto owners, Your Honor.
Yep.
So before, and I'll leave the rest of any questions or sort of my summary into to my rebuttal, and I'll just leave the court with this. Because there's cross appeals, and I always want to, at least if nothing else, say that I try to articulate what we want here is, Your Honor, our position is that the insurance policy does not allow for harvesting, and therefore the appraisal panel exceeded their statutory and contractual authority in how they did made their decision. We didn't get to touch on it, but neither party was afforded proper due process rights at that appraisal since nobody brought up this topic. And then finally, the district court got right their calculation of interest. However, I would ask this court not to simply affirm their calculation, and that is affirm the actual calculation, not the number, because the issue of harvesting is likely to have an impact on what the award is. With that, I'll thank you and I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there's further questions from Your Honors.
I don't see any further questions. Thank you for your argument. Counsel for respondent, I understand you're splitting your time and that Mr. Pham will have 5 minutes followed by 10 minutes for Mr. William. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. You can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel, Mr. Jaden. Your Honor, I'd like to start off by addressing some fundamental points, and then I will then segue into rebutting specific points that Elm Creek has made. And I'd like to open, Your Honors, by saying that the insurance policy does very much provide for harvesting. And I'll read the provision, Your Honors, the addendum page 43. The appraisers will state separately the value of the property and amount of loss. If they fail to agree, they will submit their differences to the umpire. That's section one, conditions 1B. In order for the appraisers to determine the amount of loss and the value of the property, they have to inherently determine the value of the repair. How do they determine the value of the repair? They have to determine the repair method. That is clearly within the bounds of their powers. That is undisputed between the two parties that the appraisers have the authority to determine the repair method. And harvesting is a repair method. And Your Honors, that's not me saying that. That is Mr. Pierce saying that. The definition of harvesting, as Judge Connolly cited, is read. Harvesting is a term of art in the construction and insurance industry used to describe the process of reusing materials from one location or structure to repair portions of a separate location or structure. That's exactly what the appraisal panel determined was appropriate here, taking harvested materials from the buildings that undisputedly were entitled to full replacement and using those materials to essentially do some additional patchwork repairs on the buildings that were not afforded full replacement. That's a repair method. That's factually a repair method, and that's exactly what happened. And Your Honors, let's not forget,
Mr. Pham. Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Oh, looking at the policy, though, how is it reasonable to expect that harvesting would be used as a, the policy says that our option, we will either pay the value of lost or damaged property, or another option is pay the cost of repairing or replacing the lost or damaged property and replacing it with other property of comparable material. So how does that language inform the insured that harvesting is an option under the policy?
And Your Honor, it's in that the last part of the Your Honor's comment was where it says other property of comparable material quality and use for the same purpose. So the harvested siding is not random siding that we just pick from the street. It's harvested siding from the buildings that receive full replacement. So that is the other property of comparable material that is then, instead of being having it just be wasted and thrown away, you would take it off the buildings that were entitled to full replacement and then install them or place them on the other buildings. And that's how State Farm complies with that policy obligation to provide comparable material. And Your Honor, we will concede that harvesting is not explicitly stated in the policy. That's a fairly stated point by the court. But regardless, Your Honor, so long as State Farm complies with its obligation to provide comparable material, it complies with its policy obligation to provide siding, in this case, that matches the rest of the condominium association in this case.
Does the record reflect how much harvesting would go on? I mean, is it just a small amount, or can you clarify that for me?
I'm sorry, Judge Cochran, can you please say that one more time?
Well, does the record reflect how much of the material from the buildings that are being replaced would be used on the buildings that would be repaired with the existing siding that's harvested?
Yes, Your Honor. And if Your Honor wanted like an exact data point, I couldn't give Your Honor exact data points, but on the buildings that the appraisal panel did award harvested siding, they determined that the proper repair amount was $500 per building.
Right. And I'm trying to get a sense of how did they come up with that number?
And Your Honor, you know, to be candid, we don't have like affidavits from the appraisers or anything like that. So I couldn't give the court a specific pin site to how they reached that $500 number. All I can say, Your Honors, is that the appraisal panel went out there in October 2019 and physically inspected each building. And then they conferred, and then obviously finally two of the three determined that the $500 per harvested siding was appropriate. And Your Honors, I think, you know, I've made my fundamental point. I'd just like to address a couple, Judge Connolly, I believe you had a question as well.
So Mr. Pham, your 5 minutes is up. If you want additional time, it will come from Mr. Williams' time. So,
I'm sorry. And just one final point, Your Honor, if I may, is, sure. Mr. Jaden for Elm Creek stated that the only thing that Elm Creek has to support the use of discarded and outdated is attorney argument and attorney analysis. And I just want to make sure that State Farm makes the point that that is not record evidence, nor is it legal authority. And we would just ask that the court rely on the harvesting definition as provided by Mr. Pierce. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Scott Williams. Mr. Pham and I use the tag team approach here because we figured it would make sense to sort of draw a line between the harvesting question presented, and then also the pre-award interest question where State Farm is the cross appellant. And so I'm here to address the pre-award interest question. And I think I can do that hopefully relatively quickly, even though it is a somewhat complex issue that, as you can see, there's been a number of district court decisions in federal court. And as I'm sure the court is aware, also in state court that have competing views on this. But to go to Judge Connolly's question earlier, which I think answers the dispute here today, even in the Creekview case that was decided by Judge Tostrud in federal court, the court goes on to talk about what is proper notice for purposes of triggering interest. And at every occasion that the court discusses what the state of the law is on that issue, the court refers to the fact that there is a written submission from the claimant. So the court talks about the fact that notice is sufficient when an insurer becomes aware of the insured's injuries via a letter, because that communication sparks the insurer's affirmative duty to inquire. And then it goes on to say, Various decisions within the District of Minnesota have considered what constitute written notice of a claim for purposes of prejudgment or pre-award interest, concluding that the phrase unambiguously and simply means a demand for payment or other assertion contained in a writing. And Judge Toster, they're citing to other cases, so I won't quote all of those. I'm just shorthanding in terms of taking the case law from Creekview. But I think here what the record evidence shows is that there was never a written communication from the insured outlining the claim until we received the competing repair estimate from Gavnet, the public adjuster, on September 11th of 2019, which was 1 month before the appraisal occurred on October 11th of 2019. And so if that is used as the trigger point, we have 30 days of interest. And that really, I think, resolves the issue for purposes of this.
Mr. Williams, if I agree with you, and I don't, under all the cases, that your loss report from, I think it was September 2017, is not a written notice of claim. And looking at the statute, if it's not a written notice of claim, the next date in which interest may begin to accrue is either the time of the commencement of the action or demand from arbitration. So why wouldn't I simply say, in this case, that's the lawsuit commenced on June 5th, 2019, that's when pre-award interest starts to run?
Well, the June 19th date is indeed the demand for appraisal. And we have suggested that to the court as a potential trigger date. Again, I think where the record is lacking on that, though, really the demand for appraisal in the record comes in from an affidavit of Tom Finney, who's a State Farm claim team manager, who mentions that the demand for appraisal is made when he has a discussion with Mr. Pierce. And so even then, we don't really have a writing. So I would still suggest that there would need
to be. Oh, yes, but you have a lawsuit commenced. I mean, the time of the commencement of the action was commenced on June 5th, 2019. Am I correct?
Sure, you are correct about that. Yeah.
So why wouldn't I just use that date?
You could. I don't want to.
You have a later date, and my position is, since it's got to be the earliest of one or the other, why wouldn't I use that date if I don't agree with Mr. Jaden that it was your loss report from 2 years prior is the date?
And that's a fair point. I think you would. I think in this circumstance, you are correct, because there was the litigation and arguably because the litigation involves allegations that could involve appraisal and pre-award interest, I think that would be appropriate. I wouldn't argue against that, Your Honor.
Now, explain to me why would you explain to me again, Mr. Williams, why we should not use replacement cost in terms sure. of that number?
Please. Yes. And so I think, well, again, pointing to the authority on this, there are a couple of decisions, the Eden case with Judge Beaubier, the selective case from Judge Schiltz, where both courts have said that you would only use the actual cash value, not the replacement cost value. And I think the logic here, and this ties into all of the arguments we've made here, Your Honor, in our briefing, is that an insurer doesn't owe replacement cost until repairs are completed. That is clear under the policy contract. And so to determine pre-award interest off of something that isn't owed makes little sense. And that's exactly what Judge Schiltz and Judge Beaubier have concluded as well. But the larger logic behind it, in our view, is it goes into this issue we talked about, the offer and counteroffer, and trying to have this sense of fairness to the process. The way it's set up right now, if you use a replacement cost analysis or replacement cost dollar figure for the pre-award interest, the problem is that an insurer will never have paid that by the time that you go to appraisal, unless the repairs were completed. Now, if the repairs are completed, I think it's a different analysis. Then I do think it would be fair to use the replacement cost value for purposes of assessing pre-award interest. In this situation, the repairs were not completed. And so what happens is you go to appraisal, and even if the insurer got the number dead on correct in terms of what the appraisal panel ultimately concludes is the amount of loss, there would still be an amount that the insurer hasn't paid because of the fact that the repairs have not been completed. So even if you give an insurer the deduction for the amount that has been paid when determining pre-award interest, you would never get the deduction for replacement costs because the insurer wouldn't have paid it pursuant to the policy contract.
But I guess, Mr. Williams, I'm not so sure I agree with that. You know, future damages designated award made for damages which has proven to a reasonable certainty will occur in the future. I mean, as I read it, replacement cost value designates an amount of money equivalent to the cost to replace loss that has already occurred. This loss occurred on June 11, 2017, correct?
Correct.
So why isn't the replacement cost value meant to compensate for expenses incurred to repair the damages suffered in that loss?
Because those expenses have not been incurred and may in fact never be incurred. It's not unusual that you would have a situation where replacement cost benefits are never obtained. And that's ultimately up to the insured as to whether or not it wants to seek and obtain the replacement cost benefits. So, you know, again, and I mean, I understand there are competing arguments to this, but I think where Judge Schultz and Judge Bobier have it correct on this is to say the logic is such that you're otherwise compensating someone on a pre-award interest analysis for amounts that have never been incurred. So there's been no out-of-pocket loss whatsoever. And you're effectively compensating them for something that they haven't yet paid or lost, in which they may never pay or lose. And so I think that's where it becomes a little bit fuzzy and difficult to say that pre-award interest is owed on those funds. And so there are two other real quick brief points I want to touch upon in this. One is the question of whether or not an insurer should be entitled to offsets for amounts that were paid leading up to appraisal. I think it clearly should be. In this case, the district court found that State Farm was entitled to those offsets. I don't think there's much more analysis that's needed. Again, it follows along with the logic of what pre-award interest is trying to accomplish. And then the final point I just want to touch upon is this offer-counteroffer provision, which really hasn't been addressed by the Minnesota Court of Appeals or any other appellate court. And the reason we've raised it here is because we do think this case does sort of present that question of if an insurer ultimately has a number that it presents to the insured that's closer than what the insured was demanding, does it make sense to then say that the insured gets to collect the entire amount of interest on the appraisal award, even though effectively the insured was more incorrect about the amount of loss than the insurance company was? And so I think that that's another issue that's important to consider here. But going back to the earlier argument, I think it's just true that in this case, if the pre-award interest doesn't begin to accrue until the lawsuit is commenced, a lot of those other issues, in a sense, go by the wayside, at least for purposes of this analysis, because what happened in the offer, counteroffer, and all that doesn't become as relevant. If there are no other questions, I will cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you can proceed with rebuttal when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief. There's a lot of information. I would love to talk on these. First, on the harvesting issue, to the extent that it's not fully understood in the brief, I want to bring to the court's attention this question of the argument, well, an appraisal panel determines a repair method, so this is okay. I agree that the appraisal panel determines a repair method, but it has to be based in what the policy covers. An appraisal panel can neither create nor eliminate coverage that the policy affords. The idea that if this policy doesn't offer harvesting, it's okay because the panel did it, is no more ridiculous than if a panel says, well, I know you only have $100,000 in coverage limits, but we're saying the damages are $500,000, so you owe it regardless of what your policy says. This goes to Quaid versus Secura. The panel makes the factual determinations, and the court is there to address the legal issues. What is covered under the policy is black and white, a coverage legal question. So the panel erred, it exceeded its authority. The panel's authority is to resolve factual disputes between the parties. It cannot resolve those factual disputes if they're not founded within the policy. As I said, they can neither create nor deny cover or create nor eliminate coverage under the policy. Judge Connolly brought up the reasonable expectations, and I want to sort of offer this question more to the court to think about as they're analyzing our arguments on the reasonable expectations. I mentioned that my client is a common interest community. It's made up of 80 plus unit owners and 21 buildings. So if we're going to accept that there's any merit to this harvesting issue, I offer this question of what my clients do, and that's who determines which unit owners get that full replacement cost value and which ones receive a diminished value compared to the other unit owners? Who tells Mrs. Smith her unit will be getting discarded siding while Mr. Jones gets brand new material? And how is Mrs. Smith compensated when her unit sells for less in the future than Mr. Jones? The question is, what does the community as a whole do when before this loss, which they pay money to cover, had uniformity and now they have patchwork? That is not a reasonable expectation for any client, and specifically my clients in this case.
Well, counsel, in this case, though, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought not all 21 buildings had damage.
I believe all 21 had damage, Your Honor. Four of them were determined to have full replacement of all the siding and then make those repairs. That was a unilateral or a decision based on randomness, as far as we can tell from the record. None of these buildings were, it wasn't that those four were more damaged. It was that there's four different colors and they picked four buildings to build a bull siding off of. So who makes the decision, and how does this nonprofit board enforce that? How do you go to one unit owner who's going to raise hell in a board meeting versus the other one who got a benefit? That's not a reasonable expectation of an insured in this case. Finally, with just under 2 minutes, I'd like to move on to the interest case. And I will say, I think this was fully and well briefed by both parties. This has been an ongoing back and forth for years about, we know we get it. How do we do the math? And as lawyers, I know we love to do math so much. So I appreciate the court's diligence and how they're going to look into this. But
Mr. Jaden, on that point, could you just briefly explain to us why the two federal cases dealing with replacement cost value versus actual cost are either wrong or distinguishable from your case?
I think there's a little bit of where we were and where we've gotten to. If you look at the first case, the Supreme Court in Paler did it on the full RCV. We've had two federal cases that were sort of pending at the same time, and they went on the ACV. There was some district court cases in the state court that had kind of gone either way. But the most recent cases have accepted the premise that the plain language of the statute says award. The RCV is indisputably part of the award. And as Your Honor brought in, and I don't know that I have time to analyze it, RCV is not a future damage. It's set in stone on the date of loss. I'd like to-
so we should just look at, I mean, while we all love our federal colleagues, Polar is our law. We should just follow that.
I agree. I think it sets the precedent for you to follow. Two last topics I'd like to touch on before I end is it goes into this argument of the sense of fairness and this counteroffer. Not first, an insurance company cannot make an offer, a counteroffer within the guise of 54909. To do so would violate the Unfair Claims Practices Act. They can't do it. They can adjust the loss. They can play it. They cannot make a full and final settlement of all claims. If an insurance company doesn't want to pay interest, do their singular job, and that's adjust the claim properly. There'll never be an appraisal award, and they won't ever have to pay interest on it. If I could have 30 seconds just to kind of give you what we're asking for again, Your Honors, we'd like the court to overturn the district court's decision regarding the harvesting issue. And we'd like the court to, honestly, I think we're going to ask the court really to provide what the court believes is a proper calculation and ask the district court to apply it to the facts when this case has fleshed itself out. With that, if there's no further questions, I both appreciate the court's time and I appreciate your understanding of my technological issues today.
Thank you to counsel for both parties for your arguments here today. And again, I apologize for our technology issues or Zoom's technology issues, and I appreciate your patience. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors.